A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel's written in with a question that's been sitting in the background of every news cycle for 4.5 years now, and it keeps getting shoved aside by whatever crisis is louder that week. He wants to look at the war in Ukraine as a study in narratives. What did Vladimir Putin actually say he was doing when he launched the invasion? What did Ukraine formally say back? And how have the rest of the world's positions shifted from the first weeks to now, when the conflict has settled into this grinding, protracted phase with energy grids and airspace as the new battlegrounds? He's clear about his own read, that this is a clear-cut war of aggression, and he wants us to examine whether the international response has lived up to that framing, or quietly frayed around the edges.
And the timing matters, because the war's in its fifth year, and the shape of it's changed completely. You've got Ukraine now actively telling international airlines that Russian airspace is unsafe. You've got Russia escalating strikes on the Ukrainian energy grid as winter approaches, and meanwhile the world attention has drifted to the US-Iran standoff. So the war hasn't ended, it's just become ambient.
Ambient? That's the word for it. A war is background radiation.
And that's the puzzle Daniel's pointing at. How do you have a conflict where one side's stated justification is rejected not just by the enemy, but by most of the world, and yet the war grinds on anyway? The narrative failed, and the war didn't care.
So let's pull apart the narratives. What Moscow actually claims, what Kiev formally says back, what the world has actually done about it, and then ask whether the rules-based order is holding up or quietly crumbling.
To understand the current mess, we have to go back to the beginning. To the speech Putin gave in the early hours of February 24th, 2022.
I remember watching that speech. Or rather, I remember the transcript circulating while the missiles were already hitting. The timing was the tell. The justification arrived after the invasion was already underway.
The speech is worth taking seriously as a text, because it's not just rhetoric. It's a legal and historical argument, and it's riddled with contradictions that tell you a lot about how the Kremlin thinks. Putin's core claims were threefold. First, that Ukraine wasn't a real state, that it was a historical construct created by the Soviet Union. His exact framing was that modern Ukraine was entirely the product of the Soviet era, shaped on the lands of historical Russia. Second, that NATO expansion posed an existential security threat to Russia, and that Ukraine's potential membership was the red line. And third, that the goal of the operation was to demilitarize and denazify Ukraine.
Denazify, a country whose president at the time was Jewish and democratically elected. That's not a detail. That's the whole claim collapsing on contact.
Zelensky's Jewishness was widely noted at the time, and it does make the denazification framing absurd on its face. But the Kremlin's argument was never really about actual Nazis. It was a term of art, a way of framing the Ukrainian government as illegitimate and dangerous, and it had a domestic audience. Russian state media had spent years building up the idea that Ukraine was run by far-right nationalists, that Russians in the Donbass were being persecuted, that a genocide was underway.
The genocide claim. That was the humanitarian fig leaf. The idea that Russia was intervening to protect civilians in Donetsk and Luhansk from being wiped out. And that's the claim that ended up in court.
It did. But let's stay with the speech for a minute, because the internal logic is worth examining. Putin claimed the operation was limited, defensive, and humanitarian. But the observable facts on the ground were a full-scale assault on a sovereign neighbor from multiple directions. Tanks rolling toward Kiev. That's not a limited operation. That's an invasion.
And the historical argument was just as shaky. The idea that Ukraine is a Soviet invention ignores centuries of Ukrainian identity, language, and culture that predate the Soviet Union by a long shot. The Soviets didn't create Ukraine. They conquered it, collectivized it, and starved it. The Holodomor wasn't a nation-building exercise.
Right, and that's the thing about the February speech. It wasn't a new argument. Putin had been laying out this historical revisionism for years, most notably in that long essay he wrote in 2021 about the historical unity of Russians and Ukrainians. The speech was the operationalization of that essay.
I remember reading that essay when it came out, and thinking it read less like a historical argument, and more like a legal brief for a case that was already being prepared. It had footnotes, it had citations to primary sources. It was designed to look scholarly.
That's exactly what it was. And the scholarship was selective to the point of being fraudulent. It cherry-picked moments of Russian-Ukrainian cooperation and ignored everything that contradicted the thesis. It's the kind of history you write when you've already decided the conclusion and you're working backwards to justify it.
And that's a pattern with this regime. The legal and historical arguments are always post hoc. The decision comes first. The justification follows.
So that's the foundation. And then the framing shifted. By September 2022, after the initial assault on Kyiv failed and the war bogged down, Putin held annexation ceremonies for four Ukrainian oblasts. Donetsk, Luhansk, Zaporizhia, Kherson, following what everyone outside Russia recognized as sham referendums.
The referendums were held at gunpoint in occupied territory, with armed soldiers going door to door in some places. The results were preordained, and the annexation changed the legal framing. It was no longer a special military operation to protect separatist regions. It was now a defense of Russian territory. Which meant that any Ukrainian attempt to retake those oblasts could be framed as an attack on Russia itself.
Which raises the nuclear stakes, at least rhetorically.
The annexation was a way of raising the cost of Ukrainian counteroffensives. If you're fighting for your own territory, you're defending. If you're fighting for what Russia now claims is its territory, you're the aggressor. It's a legal trap, and it worked on some level because it forced Ukraine and its allies to think carefully about escalation.
And by 2026, the framing has shifted again. Putin's recent statements frame the war as a broader confrontation with the West, not just Ukraine. It's no longer about demilitarizing a neighbor. It's about standing up to NATO, to American hegemony, to the whole Western order.
That shift matters for domestic consumption. The original framing was about a quick operation to fix a local problem. When that failed, the story had to change. Now it's a civilizational struggle. A long war against a hostile West that wants to destroy Russia. That's a much more sustainable narrative for a long conflict. You can't demilitarize Ukraine for 5 years and still call it a special operation. But you can fight the West indefinitely.
And there's a domestic logic to that shift. The Russian public was told this would be a short operation with minimal casualties. When the body bags started coming home, the story had to change. A quick fix that goes wrong is a failure. A civilizational struggle that lasts years is a test of national character. The same facts, completely different emotional valence.
So the justification has been a moving target. First, it was a historical correction and a humanitarian intervention. Then, it was a territorial annexation. Now, it's a civilizational war. The one constant is that the actual war on the ground has never matched any of the stated goals.
And that's the thing about the narrative. It's not meant to be true. It's meant to be useful. Each version serves a purpose for a particular audience at a particular moment. The February speech was aimed at the Russian public and the international community. The annexation was aimed at domestic law and the threat of escalation. The civilizational framing is aimed at sustaining morale for a long war.
So that's the story Moscow tells. Now let's look at how Kyiv formally responded and how the rest of the world reacted.
Ukraine's repudiation was remarkably fast and remarkably formal. On February 26, 2022, 2 days after the invasion began, Ukraine filed a case at the International Court of Justice. The argument was clever. Russia had justified the invasion partly on the Genocide Convention, claiming it was intervening to prevent a genocide in the Donbas. Ukraine's case flipped that on its head.
How so?
Ukraine argued that Russia was abusing the Genocide Convention itself, that Russia's claim of genocide was false, and that by using a false genocide claim to justify an invasion, Russia was itself violating the convention. The ICJ issued provisional measures in March 2022 ordering Russia to suspend military operations. Russia ignored it.
But the case mattered anyway.
It mattered because it put the legal repudiation on the record. It wasn't just Ukraine saying Russia is wrong, it was Ukraine saying Russia's own legal justification is a fraud, and we're going to prove it in the highest court available. The case is still winding its way through the ICJ, and it's a significant piece of the legal architecture around this war.
And there's something almost elegant about the legal strategy. Russia used a humanitarian treaty as a weapon. Ukraine turned that weapon back on Russia and said, "You're not just violating the Genocide Convention, you're perverting it. You're using it as a pretext for the very kind of violence it was designed to prevent."
That's the argument in a nutshell, and it's a good one. The Genocide Convention was created after the Holocaust to prevent mass atrocities. Using it as a cover for an invasion is a kind of legal sacrilege. Ukraine's case is essentially saying that Russia has weaponized the international legal order itself.
And then there was the UN General Assembly. March 2, 2022, an emergency special session. The resolution condemning Russia's invasion passed with 141 countries in favor.
That's a huge number, but the abstentions and no votes are the more interesting part of the story. China abstained, India abstained, a significant bloc of countries from the global south abstained or voted against. 35 countries abstained, 5 voted against, including Russia, Belarus, North Korea, Syria, and Eritrea.
So the world wasn't unified. The headline number looked like overwhelming condemnation, but underneath it was a fracture that's only grown since.
That's the thing Daniel's pointing at. The initial international position was strong in rhetoric, but divided in practice. The EU imposed sanctions packages. The US-led coalition sent military aid. NATO rallied. But the abstention bloc represented a huge chunk of the world's population. China and India together are nearly 3 billion people. Their neutrality wasn't a footnote.
By 2026, that neutrality has hardened into something more structural. There's a bloc of countries that never sanctioned Russia, that continue to trade with Russia, that buy Russian energy at a discount and resell it. The sanctions regime has leaks everywhere.
The energy picture is a good example. Russia's oil exports didn't collapse. They rerouted. India became a major buyer of Russian crude, refined it, and sold the products to Europe. So European consumers were still, indirectly, buying Russian energy while their governments were sanctioning it. The sanctions were real but porous.
Western unity has frayed. Aid fatigue is real. The US Congress had fights over Ukraine funding. European countries have domestic political pressures. The initial wave of solidarity was never going to last 5 years unchanged.
Which brings us to the current diplomatic situation. August 2026, U.S. envoys Steve Witkoff and Jared Kushner reportedly visited Moscow and Kyiv to explore a potential ceasefire. That's a significant shift in U.S. diplomatic engagement.
Witkoff and Kushner. Those aren't career diplomats. Those are people from the Trump orbit, business guys with personal relationships. Sending them signals a particular kind of approach, one based on deal-making rather than the traditional State Department machinery.
The fact that they went to both Moscow and Kyiv suggests the U.S. is actively exploring what a negotiated end might look like. Whether that's serious or just exploratory is hard to say from outside. But the fact that it's happening at all tells you the war has entered a phase where both sides are at least entertaining the possibility of talks.
While simultaneously escalating on the ground. That's the paradox of protracted conflict. The diplomacy and the escalation happen at the same time, because each side wants to negotiate from a position of strength.
The escalation right now is focused on energy. Russia has been intensifying attacks on Ukraine's energy infrastructure, targeting the grid specifically to cripple civilian life as winter approaches. This is a deliberate strategy. You hit the power plants, the substations, the transmission lines. You make it so that ordinary Ukrainians freeze in the dark.
It's not new, but the intensity has picked up. And it's a war crime under international law to target civilian infrastructure. Not that the legal designation has slowed anything down.
The legal framework exists, but enforcement is the problem. The ICJ can issue orders, the ICC can issue arrest warrants, and Russia just keeps going. The warrants for Putin and his officials over the forced deportation of Ukrainian children were a significant moment, but they haven't changed the battlefield.
Meanwhile, Ukraine is fighting back in a different domain, the airspace. Ukraine is urging international airlines to avoid Russian airspace, arguing it's unsafe, and that's not just a rhetorical point. There's a real question about whether commercial aircraft flying over Russia are at risk, either from the conflict itself or from the legal and insurance implications.
This is where it gets interesting. Russian airspace has been closed to many Western airlines since 2022, when Russia closed its airspace to carriers from countries that sanctioned it. But some airlines still fly over Russia, particularly from Asia and the Middle East. and Ukraine is now actively campaigning to make that stop.
The argument is that Russian airspace is unsafe because of the war, and because of the risk of planes being grounded or confiscated. Remember, after the sanctions hit, Russia seized hundreds of leased aircraft that belonged to Western leasing companies. The planes were re-registered in Russia, and the lessors just lost them. Billions of dollars of assets. Gone.
That's a huge deal for the aviation industry. The leasing companies, mostly based in Ireland, wrote off massive losses, and the insurance implications are still being litigated. If you fly into Russian airspace and something happens, are you insured? The underwriters have been very cautious about covering flights into conflict zones.
Ukraine's campaign is partly about safety and partly about economics. If airlines stop flying over Russia, that's revenue loss for Russia and overflight fees, and it increases Russia's isolation. It's a different kind of pressure than sanctions, but it's real.
It connects to a broader question about international aviation law. The rules around airspace sovereignty are clear. A country controls the airspace over its territory. But what happens when a country is engaged in a war and its airspace becomes a risk? There's a precedent in the MH17 shootdown in 2014 when a Malaysian airliner was shot down over eastern Ukraine by a Russian missile. That changed how airlines thought about conflict zones.
Now Ukraine is essentially saying that Russian airspace is the new conflict zone. The risk isn't just a missile, it's the legal and financial exposure. If you fly over Russia and something goes wrong, you're on your own.
Before we wrap up, Hilbert's been shuffling some papers back there, and it turns out he has a weirdly specific connection to this.
Lloyd's of London, Form AVN 52C, the War Risk Exclusion. I used to have to check every single flight manifest against that cause.
Say more.
I did logistics coordination for a small charter outfit that flew humanitarian aid into eastern Ukraine in 2014-2015. We had a couple of old Antonovs, and every flight into Donetsk or Luhansk, the insurance underwriters wouldn't touch it. There was a specific exclusion clause for areas of active military conflict. You either flew uninsured or you didn't fly.
The insurance market was already treating eastern Ukraine as a war zone before the full invasion.
They had it mapped out by grid coordinates. Certain areas, no coverage. The underwriters didn't care about the politics, they cared about the risk. And the risk was a missile or a surface-to-air system. We had to get special dispensation for each flight, and half the time the answer was no.
When Ukraine says Russian airspace is unsafe, they're not just making a political point. They're pointing at a real insurance problem.
The insurance is the whole thing. If the underwriters won't cover a route, the airline can't fly it, the banks won't finance the plane, the lessors won't lease it. The insurance is the linchpin. And right now, the underwriters are looking at Russian airspace the same way they looked at Donetsk in 2014. They're just waiting for the first big loss.
The confiscation risk makes it worse. In 2014, the risk was a missile. Now it's also the Russian government just taking the plane. That's a different kind of loss, and it's harder to price.
We had a binder of flight manifests and insurance paperwork. I kept it. It's in a box somewhere. Every page had that exclusion clause stamped on it. Areas of active military conflict, no coverage. It was the same stamp every time.
The airspace dispute isn't really about aviation law. It's about who bears the risk, and whether the insurance market has decided that Russian airspace is uninsurable.
The insurance market decides where planes fly. Not governments, not airlines, the underwriters. And they're a lot more conservative than any foreign ministry.
That's a useful lens. The international community can pass resolutions and issue statements, but the actual constraints on conflict are often financial. Insurance, reinsurance, shipping rates, energy prices. The war is fought in those markets as much as on the battlefield.
That's the note to end on, because it reminds us that this war isn't just about tanks and missiles. It's about the infrastructure of global commerce, and how conflict disrupts it in ways that no UN resolution can fix.
The misconception worth naming here is that the international community has been unified in condemning Russia. The 141 vote looked like unity, but the abstentions told a different story. China, India, much of the global south. They never signed on to the sanctions regime. And over time, that bloc has only grown more comfortable with its neutrality.
The other misconception is that the conflict is a stalemate with no ongoing escalation. The front lines may not have moved much, but the war has expanded into new domains. The energy grid, the airspace, the insurance markets. The war is still actively evolving, just not in the way the maps show.
which leaves the open question. Can a ceasefire brokered by U.S. envoys actually hold, given how fundamentally incompatible the two sides' narratives are? Russia says it's fighting the West. Ukraine says it's defending its existence. Those stories don't meet in the middle.
The deeper question is, what happens to the international order if the rules-based response to aggression remains as fractured as it is now? If a clear-cut war of aggression can grind on for 5 years, with a significant chunk of the world treating it as someone else's problem, what does that tell the next aggressor?
The energy grid attacks and the airspace disputes are setting precedents. Future wars will look like this, not just battlefields, but grids and flight paths and insurance exclusions. And the world's response will be shaped by whether this war's response made any sense at all.
When the history of this war is written, the question won't just be who won. It'll be whether the world's response made any sense at all.
Thanks to our producer, Hilbert Flumingtop, for keeping the show running.
This has been My Weird Prompts. Email us at show@myweirdprompts.com.
We'll be back soon.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The hosts dig in, the hosts dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too, from half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from law. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.